Estonia within 2 hours of the exchange out of their reach. The air attaché promised me a C-37 in Tallinn, but Forsyth, please remind him to have the aircraft there. I do not want to have to fly economy on an Estonian air flight to Trondheim to get him clear. Later, as he walked Benford to the departure gate at Venizelos, Forsyth took him by the arm. "Quite an operation you've put together here, Simon," he said. "You will have Russians, Estonians, SVR, and CIA at the bridge, all fingering their weapons nervously. God willing, Marble will be standing in the night fog, waiting to be exchanged." Benford stopped and turned toward Forsyth. "Tom, Gable and Diva must stay black. No cell phones, no contact, nothing that would give the center even the remotest opportunity to attempt a hostile action." "Gable's already disappeared," said Forsyth. "As of yesterday afternoon, even I don't know where he is." Benford nodded. "We have no choice. We've got to move ahead as if she's already agreed. I want Marble there physically before they decide to execute him. This is our one chance." Benford stared out the window at the tarmac. "Gable will convince her. He has to." In the station in Tallinn, Estonia, the young chief of station put down his coffee cup and sat up when he read Benford's cable, relayed by headquarters. He stuck his head around the corner and called his wife into the office. It was just the two of them, a tandem couple. Together they reread the cable several times. She stood behind him, her chin on his shoulder, making a list of things to do quickly: hotels, cars, radios, binoculars. Per Benford's instructions, the young COS called his liaison contact in Kaipo, the Kaitsopolizei, to ask for an urgent meeting. "Escort in town? Follow car to Narva? Overwatch at the bridge? Kick our former Russian tenants in the bloody balls?" "Delighted," Kaipo said. "Everything will be arranged." Benford arrived in Tallinn from Venizelos via Tempelhof on Lufthansa. With a brief stop at a hotel in the old town, Benford dragged the eager young COS on a pounding casing and timing run to Narva and back. A nondescript Lada followed them sporadically on the E-20, but disappeared on the outskirts of Narva. The Russians knew where the action was going to be. On the way back to Tallinn, Benford stopped at a highway cafe grill to see how the Lada would react. Surveillance proceeded 200 meters and waited on the side of the highway. Benford made himself stretch out a lunch of boiled sausages, pickles, herring, Baltic Rosales salad, black bread, dark loamy beers. He hoped the goons in the car were hungry. Benford's hotel room had been entered, but they had been very good. None of the traditional telltales Benford had left for them had been disturbed. The stray hairs, the talcum, the aligned corners on the notepad on the desk. But they weren't as good as Benford. COS Tallinn watched, fascinated, as Benford used a rice-grain-sized Stanhope lens concealed on the bezel of his wristwatch to examine the back cover of the decoy cell phone left in a side pocket of his suitcase. Benford looked up, nodded. The microscribe marks on the cover were misaligned. They had pried the back off and probably downloaded the useless memory. Other preparations were underway. In St. Petersburg, the director of the SVR office for the Leningrad Oblast was called by Yasinyevo on the director's Veche phone. He was informed only that there would be an exchange. He was told to organize and deploy a team to handle a prisoner for release, and then to escort a person of importance from the Narva Bridge to Ivangorod, and then to St. Petersburg in the shortest time possible. The director was authorized to call the St. Petersburg FSB and the Oblast Border Guard Service to provide support during the exchange. A Colonel Zhuganov in Moscow ordered and stipulated that there should be no trouble whatsoever during the exchange, and that it should be accomplished with the greatest secrecy. The St. Petersburg director acknowledged the directions and subsequently asked for and received approval to transport the important person from Ivangorod to St. Petersburg by the Border Guard helicopter. A Yak-40 executive jet, part of the presidential squadron, would fly the repatriated individual, whoever the devil he was, thought the Leningrad chief, the rest of the way to Moscow. The exchange for marble was scheduled the next day at 1400 Zulu. Perhaps because they were all keyed up, perhaps because Forsythe worried about Gable, perhaps because he knew Nate had been frozen out of the operation and was headed to Washington, he took Nate out for a beer. They were sitting under pale plane trees at the Scalacchia Taverna down the hill from the embassy. Nate had been mooning around the station, waiting for his flight, and Forsythe felt sorry for the kid. He'd been through a lot, been scratched up pretty good. Forsythe knew what else was nagging at him, apart from Nate's usual fretting about his hall file and career. So Forsythe walked him up the steep flight of stairs to the polished wood entrance of the taverna, and they sat outside listening to the city quiet down for the midday break. Nate asked Forsythe if Diva was back in Russia now, after she had blown marble up, then tossed back his beer and signaled for another. Forsythe looked at him pretty sharpish, and Nate told him he had read the restricted handling file in the office when Maggie wasn't looking, and knew the whole story, about Benford's plan, about Dominica burning marble. Didn't we try to protect our assets? How could she? Russians. Marble wouldn't have done it. He was a guy apart. Forsythe leaned into it, gave it to him between the eyes, told him he had his head up his ass. Forsythe said that he was considering kicking it farther up his ass for sneaking the RH traffic. Dominica hadn't known about the plan to burn marble, Forsythe said. She was following orders, doing what Benford had told her to do. She had no knowledge of the canary trap, of the fatal words she was told to repeat. She was directed not to tell Nate any of it. She had discipline. She was the professional. She had broken down when they told her about marble. Nate was silent for 10 minutes. He told Forsythe he was going to the safe house to see her. "Don't bother," said Forsythe. "We closed it up yesterday. She's with Gable, and even I don't know where Gable is." He told Nate about Benford's spy swap, about the 2-lane highway bridge in Estonia. "We're playing this by Moscow rules, well, Narva rules anyway, because we have only one shot at this." Nate's jaw was set. "Tom, I have to see her. You have to help me." "I couldn't if I wanted to," said Forsythe. "There's one point on the surface of the globe where it's possible that she will show up tomorrow, and that's 50-50. Nate understood that Forsythe was telling him because he would let him go. For Nate, the next 24 hours were a journey of self-loathing and guilt. He started the physical journey after getting up from the table and walking away from Forsythe, who let him go and knew what he was going to try to do, because if he didn't try, it would be even worse than it was now. He had a day to get there. The Athens traffic didn't move, and the white Aegean light shone through the windows of the taxi, and the sweat ran down his back onto the plastic seats, and he threw the euros down and went into the terminal and bought a bag and a toothbrush and a t-shirt and a ticket on the next flight to Germany, to Munich. And the cattle in line didn't move, and he almost started yelling but limped through security and didn't even register the lift as they took off, and he wondered why the plane was flying so slowly over the Alps, and the articulated bus in Munich circled the whole airport twice before coming to a halt at the sliding doors, and he told himself not to hurry up the stairs. Cameras were everywhere, and his stitches were acting up, itching. The endless concourse in Munich with a knockwurst and a beer, which he threw up 5 minutes later, and the two Vopos, cops with MP5s, asking him for his passport and boarding pass, almost told them he was too much in a hurry, and the epaulets in the booth looking at him for an extra beat, and he wanted to reach through and grab his papers but willed his hand to stay at his side, wet and trembling. The waiting lounge was full of lumpy bolts with string-tied suitcases, and he wanted to shoulder his way through them and get to the gate, but they clumped up in front of him, and the announcement of a 2-hour delay sent his sour stomach sinking, and he checked his watch for the 100th time as he sat in the cracked plastic chair, hearing the bolts chatter and smelled them eat bread and sausage. He made it to the bathroom in time to vomit on an empty stomach, an agony, and he lifted his shirt to check that he hadn't popped any stitches. And his skin was pink and hot to the touch, but nothing was leaking. Back out at the gate, he fell asleep in a sweat, seeing her face and hearing her voice. Someone kicked his feet going by and he woke to get in line, semi-conscious and numb with a buzz in his head and packed tight, and they made him wait on the tarmac until they resolved the technical difficulty 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, and the bolts wouldn't stop talking, and Nate's head buzzed and his ears would not clear when they took off, and the flight attendant asked him if he was all right. 2 hours later, and they weren't descending because of the fog, and they were going to divert to Helsinki. He couldn't bear that, and he closed his eyes and put his head on the seat back, and the fog lifted in time, and the customs table was stainless steel and the dinky modern Tallinn airport, and the anonymous throwaway mobile phone purchased at the airport didn't work, and the rental car had a steering wheel that was loose on the column, but he didn't have time to swap cars, and the little engine rattled, and he was going too fast, and fucked up on the roundabout outside Tallinn and went south on the E67, until a sign told him he was headed for goddamn Riga, and he got turned around and on the E20, with the double carriage rigs buffeting the wobbly little car, and the radar cop pulled him over and took his time before tearing off the ticket and saluting him, and the towns rolled past, alien names and an alien moonscape of flat hills and windbreak trees beside muddy farms, and it was the city limits of Narva, dingy Narva. And it was afternoon, and the clouds were thick across the sky, and he found the castle and the bridge, Russia across the water. But something made him get out of there. Don't heat up the site. The last scrap of operational discipline. He drove around town hoping for a glimpse of her, but there was no chance, and he fought the guilt and the shame and dredged up the last scrap of operational discipline, and he sat in a parking lot downtown, the car rocking as the trams went by, and Nate's hands trembled, and he sat behind the fogged-up windshield. The minute hand on the dash was ticking backward, and he splashed cold water on his face and armpits and stomach. The stitches still itched. In the gas station and looked at his face, one side black and blue like the Phantom of the Opera, some lover he had been, and he shrugged on the Greek flag t-shirt and ate a Narva sandwich with lettuce going brown on the edges and the lard oozing onto the waxed paper, and Forsyth had told him sundown, so he started the car, and he couldn't feel his legs and feet on the clutch as he drove back toward the bridge. But the striped sawhorse was already up, and the jeep was parked sideways on the center line, and he told the soldier he was part of the clambake down the road. But the blue eyes beneath the forage cap and the buzz cut didn't understand clambake, and was staring again at Nate's passport when he popped the clutch and went around the sawhorse and heard the police whistle but didn't think they would shoot, and up ahead he saw a van and a jeep, and Benford standing there and his vision blurred. Don't know if it's the wobbly steering wheel or me. And he let out the clutch and coasted down toward him quietly, the last scrap of operational discipline left to him. Estonian beet salad. Chop in half-inch diced boiled beets, boiled potatoes, pickles, peeled apples, hard-boiled eggs, cooked beef or pork, and salt herring, soaked overnight and cleaned, and mix with sour cream, mustard, sugar, pepper, and vinegar until incorporated. Chill and serve. Chapter 41. Gable dragged Dominika from the safe house. She came along grudgingly, and they went to ground. They talked for a full day in a room Gable had booked in Alias at the Astor Palace, 20 clicks out of Athens, overlooking the bay. They had registered as a married couple, easier that way. Gable never recognized the off-duty cop moonlighting behind the hotel desk, but the cop knew the big American and picked up the phone. Gable didn't even give it 50-50. Dominika told Bratok that she no longer respected or trusted him. They had all used her. He listened with his purple halo and the Aegean light coming through the windows while she told him that ever since ballet school, her choices had been taken away. She had been shoved this way and that. The things most dear to her had been stolen. It was why she had decided to work with them. Nate and Bratok and Forsyth had been like family. They knew what she needed. And everyone was so smart, so professional. But the result turned out the same. They had colluded against her. Even the general had broken faith. Her Russian mind saw conspiracy. Her Russian soul felt betrayal. She would not work with them. She told him she had decided that she would not stay in Russia either. She realized the futility of defying the system. The Vlasti would always win. All that remained was to decide where she would go. If the Americans would permit her to resettle in the United States, she would go there. If they refused to accept her defection, she would consider settling in a third country. If the CIA blocked her, she would return to Russia as a civilian. But she was quitting. She was out. Gable let her talk and brewed tea for her and put lemon in the Perrier and listened. When she became tired, they sat on the balcony with their feet on the railing and looked at the turquoise water, and he told her stories about his early assignments as a young officer and made her laugh. He kept her laughing over a lunch of fried calamari with parsley, lemon, and oil, and as the afternoon shadows lengthened, they walked around the gardens. Gable told her that he was not going to try to persuade her to do anything. Dominica smiled and said, "Which is the first step in persuading me to do exactly what you want?" Gable laughed and took her back to their room and let her take a nap in the bedroom while he sat awake on the balcony. That evening, Dominica put on a summer dress and sandals, and they took a rattletrap bus along the coast to a small fish restaurant in Lagonisi, and Dominica ordered baked sardines and grape leaves, and shrimp iuvetsi, baked with tomatoes, ouzo, and feta, and grilled swordfish. And Gable ordered two wines, a bottle of ice-cold Aspralithi, and an aluminum beaker of pungent Retsina. They stopped at another taverna for a coffee, and Gable ordered two glasses of Mavrodaphne, sweet and arterial black from southern Greece, which once turned Homer's sea wine dark. The Christmas lights on the canopy of the taverna glowed, and small waves chuckled on the beach beyond, invisible in the night. Looking at Gable's big beefy face and brush-cut hair, Dominica waited, leaning back against the ropes, waiting for him to begin throwing punches. "You're going to talk to me now, aren't you, Bratok?" said Dominica. Gable ignored her and said he wanted her to think about the whole thing seriously. He wanted her to reconsider on her own terms. He would explain how he saw that, what that would mean for her. She agreed to listen. She expected his tricks, but his steady purple bloom told her he would probably tell her the truth. Probably. Gable said he thought her original reasons for joining the SVR were just and right and fine. She could serve her country. She could excel at a demanding job. Turned out she was good at it. But the promise of it all turned to ashes because of the beastliness of the system. There was nothing left. "Am I right so far?" he asked. Dominica sat back and nodded. His purple was steady and strong. "Okay," said Gable. "Now, ops or luck or fate comes along and you meet Nate Nash, and he's unlike anyone you ever met before. And that goes for the other handsome senior officers in the CIA, and you stick your big toe in the water and see how it feels, maybe to get back at the bastards. It isn't about money or ideology. It's your self-worth." Gable signaled a waiter for two more glasses of wine. "Then something screwy happens. You realize that you thrive on this life, on the risk and the trickiness and the ice and the deception and the secret in your head every day. You thrive on it. You develop a real taste for it." The wine came, and Gable sipped. "How am I doing?" he said. Dominica crossed her arms. "So, suddenly you're betrayed again, this time by the people you thought were the good guys. But that would be the wrong way to think about it." Dominica blinked at Gable sideways. "The general and Benford and all of us wanted you to assume the general's place as our top gun in Moscow. Maybe we should have asked you, but it didn't happen. So now we're in the last act, and Benford is trying to get you back inside Moscow, and sweetheart, it's up to you. No one can force you. You have to decide on your own." Dominica looked out at the black water, then back at Gable. "What are you going to do without all this?" he asked. "What are you going to do without your fix?" Dominica closed her eyes and shook her head. "You think I cannot live without this?" she said. "Forget about the CIA. Think about the general. He'd tell you the same thing. Go back and get to work. Don't think about the CIA for the first 6 months, a year. Don't give those bastards at the center an inch. Run them over. You have a head start now. Begin building your career. Go back and finish with your uncle. Tell the center what he did. Make sure he gets what he deserves. You'll be on the winning side, and it'll make you seem unpredictable and dangerous. First you caught Korchnoi, now you demolish your own uncle. They'll be scared of you. Choose, demand. Force them to give you an important job, something with a lot of access, somewhere in the Americas Department, Line KR, whatever. Run your shop like you mean it. Recruit foreigners, cause trouble, catch spies, make allies. Throw your enemies off balance. Be bitchy around the conference table. Dominica tried not to smile. "Bitchy. This means zlobnish, I think," she said. "Once a year, twice, you come out on an operation of your choosing and I'll be there. You tell us what you want to tell us. You call the shots on internal communications. If you need to see us in Moscow, I'll personally make sure you're safe. You want commo gear? We'll give you some. You need help? You got it. You want us to go away? We're gone." "And would Nathaniel be involved in the future?" she asked. "People think it would be ill-advised to bring the two of you together, given the operational history, but I'm here to tell you that if you want him handling outside meetings, we can arrange that."
"You're being very accommodating," said Dominica.
"This work, Dominica, it's in your blood. You can't leave it alone. It's in your nose and under your nails and growing out of the tips of your hair. Admit it."
"I would never have come to dinner with you if I knew you were a Yanchar," she said. "Did the CIA take you from your crib and train you from youth?"
"Admit it," said Gable.
The air was filled with purple. "And now you're being Nicol Torni," she said.
"You know I'm right. Admit it."
She was enveloped in it.
"Может быть," Dominica said.
"Perhaps."
"Dominica," he said.
His purple cloud had descended from above his head and was swirling between them. Dominica's face was calm and clear.
"Perhaps."
"Think about what I said. I want you to agree, you know that, but whatever you decide, you have to make up your mind by tomorrow."
"I see," said Dominica. "I detect another surprise from you. Why must I decide by tomorrow, dear Bratok?"
"Because we need you. Benford needs you. In Estonia, tomorrow."
She looked at him coolly, her hands flat on the table. "Tell me why, please."
And Gable told her about the swap in Estonia, watching her eyes narrow. "Don't get mad again," said Gable. "I didn't tell you before because I wanted to talk to you without it hanging over our heads."
"And you are not making this up?" said Dominica.
"You're going to be walking past him on the freaking bridge," said Gable. "It would be difficult to fake it."
"I assume the CIA could build a bridge."
"Be serious," said Gable.
"All right, I will be serious," said Dominica. "By telling me this, you are again making me the general's executioner. You are not giving me a choice at all."
"What did I tell you before?" said Gable. "It is your choice. You can decide right now, right here, not to continue. We already owe you a modest resettlement. You have a bank account. I will call Benford and then personally fly with you to the United States tomorrow."
"And the general?" she said.
Gable shrugged. "He was the best Russian asset we ever had. He lasted 14 years. He engineered his own demise because he was at the end of his run. He thought he found in you a replacement for his work. He wanted continuity. But it was his decision. Assets live and die. You are bound by the situation to the extent you let yourself be.
You do not believe this, said Dominica. Nate has said you told him that the most important thing ever is the safety and well-being of your assets. Your conscience would not let you abandon him.
And perhaps you're right, said Gable. To rescue the general from the Lefortovo cellars would be a good start as we resume our work.
Dominica stared at him and took a sip of wine. Gable raised an eyebrow and looked her in the eyes. She knew he was telling the truth. You are all such bastards.
Flight to Latvia is at 10 o'clock.
I wish you a pleasant flight, she said. They took the last bus back to the Astor Palace. They sat beside each other but did not talk for the 15-minute ride. They walked wordlessly through the lobby with the scent of bougainvillea in the sea and went out to the sweeping patio and ordered mineral waters and watched the lights of the ferry to Rhodes move across the horizon. Gable didn't think he had reeled her in. She was too indignant, too angry. He could tell when someone was wavering and when someone had made up her mind. Dominica had what it takes, but she couldn't be bullied. Benford's face would fall when Gable showed up without her. The worst part would be seeing the guards across the bridge leading Marble away. No swap. Carry out the sentence. But he had made his pitch. She knew he was her friend. She knew it was up to her. They took the elevator to their floor. The curving corridor of the hotel was quiet. It did not seem as if anyone else was on the floor. A magnetic servo whine from the elevator shafts was the only sound in the air. Dominica unlocked the door and stepped inside. Neither of them heard the footsteps. The two men had taken off their shoes and were padding toward them from either end of the corridor in a silent rush. Dominica saw them as she turned and tried to pull Gable into the room, but the men shouldered their way inside, flinging the door shut. Lamps on each bedside table gave the only light in the room. One of the men in a low growl said, "Ne bojša mojsi tabak pomotebje." Don't be afraid. We're here to rescue you. And Dominica registered that he used the formal you. The four of them stood stock still for an instant, the silence before the explosion. She could see the butt of a pistol in one man's belt. Both men were huge, giants from Georgia, judging from their faces. Dominica pushed past Gable and into the arms of one of the men, sobbing as if relieved to be rescued. The other monster launched himself at Gable, who stepped back a quarter turn and drove the man past him into the end table and lamp, demolishing both. But the man was up, too fast, too agile for his size, and they locked arms and wrapped legs and went down to the floor, each looking for openings, eyes, throat, genitals, joints. Dominica put one arm around the neck of her man, which slowed him from doubling up on Gable. He smelled of wet dog and garlic, and she gagged and turned to look at the heaving mass that was Gable and the Russian. She realized with sudden clarity that she would not allow Bratok to be hurt. She pawed the front of her man's shirt front and down to his belt and felt the checkered grip of the small pistol and did not bother to draw it clear, but reached in and thumbed the safety off and pulled the trigger as fast as she could, 3 times, 4 times, and the muffled shots were drowned out by the man's scream and he was on his back, writhing, his shirt front and trousers a mass of blood. Holding the pistol at her side, Dominica walked over to the other Russian, who had Gable pinned to the floor with a forearm against his throat. The second time a CIA man is fighting for me, Dominica thought, and she reached for the man's hair and pulled his head back, relieving the pressure on Bratok's neck. The Georgian's head swung around, eyes wide to see who had pulled his hair, and Dominica put the barrel of the gun under his chin, turned her face to avoid the blood spray, and careful to point the muzzle away from Gable, pulled the trigger twice. The Georgian spat blood, toppled sideways, and did not move. The first man continued writhing on the now wet rug. Gable got up and reached to take the pistol from her, but Dominica turned away and would not let him. Amazed, Gable watched her walk over to the first man, bend down, and shielding her face with her free hand, put the muzzle of the pistol against his forehead and pull the trigger twice. The man's head bounced once on the floor.
Dominica threw the empty pistol, its slide locked back, into the corner of the room. Gable had a bruise under his left eye and fingernail scratch marks on his right cheek and neck. They both knew there could have been no other way with these two mechanics. He studied Dominica intently in the nearly dark room, her chest rising and falling, a little blood on her arm. "I will be a little bitchy from now on," she said. "Zlobnish." Shrimp Uvetzi. Saute onion, red pepper flakes, and garlic. Add chopped tomato, oregano, and ouzo, and reduce to thick sauce. Add shrimp. Stir in chopped parsley and cook briefly. Transfer to baking dish, top with feta cheese, and bake in medium-high oven until bubbling. Chapter 42. The next evening, at 1700 hours, a bank of fog settled low over the Narva River in an otherwise clear night sky. Thick and ragged as a plug of surgical cotton torn from the box, the fog occasionally licked up over the roadway of the bridge. The lamps along the bridgeway came on and caught the fog, blowing right to left, making it seem as if the bridge itself were moving on casters along the riverbank. Well above the fog bank, the tower of Hermann Castle on the west bank faced the deserted battlements of the Ivangorod fortress on the east bank. On the Russian side of the bridge, two light trucks were positioned lengthwise across the roadway. Six border guards in camouflage utility uniforms were slouching around the trucks. Behind them was a small armored personnel carrier, a Tigra, with a light machine gun mounted on a ring turret in the roof. There was no one on the gun, which was locked on its pintles, pointed at the sky. Behind these vehicles, parked along the side of the road that led past the convenience store and administration building, were five cars from St. Petersburg SVR, two Mercedes and three BMWs. The drivers stood together in the dark, talking. The rest of the SVR men had entered the checkpoint toll booth and were waiting out of sight, following orders to stay discreet. On the sloping riverbank below the bridge, two border guards stood completely enveloped in the fog, dripping wet. On the Estonian side of the bridge, Benford sat 50 meters from the bridge inside a van parked in the center of the road. He could look straight down the roadway of the bridge at the parked Russian vehicles. Next to Benford's van, a small Kaipo jeep was pulled over on the shoulder. Four black-suited troopers sat in the jeep smoking. Kaipo had intended to put two spotters in the bastion of the Hermann Castle Tower, but the ministry did not have the budget for night scopes. The lights on the bridge would have to be enough. There was a sound of squeaking brake pads and the crunch of tires on the gravel shoulder, a car coasting to a stop. Benford saw Nate get out of a little green compact, his hair down over his forehead, a ridiculous blue and white. No, it was the Greek flag on his t-shirt. Benford got out of the van and walked back to the car. "What are you doing here, Nash?" said Benford in a low, even voice. "And what is that ridiculous shirt you're wearing? Do you know what is supposed to happen in a half hour? Have the kindness to get into the van and stay out of sight. You need a shower." Benford steered Nate into the van and slid the door closed. The Kaipo troopers in the jeep looked over and wondered what was going on. Benford walked over to them and accepted an offered cigarette. The troopers were respectfully quiet. Benford could see more activity at the other end of the bridge. The light trucks parked lengthwise across the bridge were separated slightly, and the Tigra APC had moved between them. A soldier had unlimbered the gun on the roof. From behind Benford came the sound of another vehicle, and Gable pulled up in a nondescript black sedan. He appeared to be alone in the car. Gable got out and walked toward Benford. "Tell me what you've done," said Benford. "Tell me you have her."
"The Russians tried for her last night in Athens. A rescue team, they called themselves. I have no idea how they tracked us. Someone the Russians have at the hotel, the cops, I don't know. She killed both of them. Executed them."
The Kaipo troopers had climbed out of their jeep and were standing behind it, looking at the Russian side of the bridge through binoculars.
She killed them?
Where is she right now? Asked Benford. Do we have someone to swap for Marble?
She told me no. For 6 hours it was no. Nothing I could say to change her mind. The next morning I was going to turn her over to Forsythe, the flyer to the States, and she was waiting for me by the car. Waxing the two center goons may have done the trick, I don't know. She's seriously furious.
Benford looked as though he was going to pass out. She's in the back seat, lying down. She got back there as we entered Narva. I want her to change the profile.
Benford blew out a stream of smoke. It had been nearly 72 hours of not knowing.
She agreed? Benford asked.
Yes and no. She told me to go to hell that she was doing it to spring Marble for no other reason. Said she's going back to think about working with us. In the meantime, she intends to raise hell in the center. We might have an agent, we might not. She'll let us know.
What does that mean? Said Benford.
Gable ignored the question.
Another thing. Nash is an issue. She asked about him.
Benford started laughing.
What? Said Gable.
Nash is in the van.
I don't know how he did it, but he got here from Athens and showed up. That's his car behind the van.
State of mind? Asked Gable.
Agitated, intense, exhausted.
What are you thinking?
What I'm thinking is that we let them talk for a few minutes. Might be good for both of them. Leave her with a memory to take back with her. Settle him down. I can pull the car up and get her into the back of the van so no one sees.
Okay, we're waiting anyway.
But wait till I talk to Nash for a second.
Benford slid the van door open, climbed in, and sat beside Nate on the middle bench seat. Nash had found a jacket in the back and had run his fingers through his hair. He looked tired, but presentable. Benford slid the door partly closed and leaned back in the seat.
Diva and Gable have arrived. She's in the car. Last night the Russians tried to rescue her and she killed two men. She's agreed to return to Russia only because of the swap to free Marble. As for working inside, she has not made any commitment, and we do not know the extent to which she is now or in the future will be our agent. We have a few minutes, and Gable believes it would be salutary for Diva to speak with you. I need you to become her recruiting officer once again. I need you to be inspirational. I need you to speak to her of duty and mission and long-term espionage. There's only one way to play this that will not result in her arrest at the other end of that bridge. As a case officer preparing his agent. Otherwise, it will break her composure. Can you do this?
Nate nodded.
Benford exited the van and Nate heard engine noise and the click of a door, and the back of the van opened up and Dominica quickly stepped inside and the door slammed shut. She squeezed past the rear seat and sat down beside him. She was dressed in a simple navy dress with a light coat of the same color. Gable had insisted on sensible black laced shoes and beige hose. She had pinned her hair up and wore no makeup, a matron just out of CIA captivity. The blue eyes were the same, and she looked at Nate, searching his face. He was bathed in a pale purple glow. It told her he was in pain. For the first time in his young career, Nate did not automatically think about the ramifications of breaking the rules, of ignoring Benford, of blowing a hole in his rep. He leaned forward, grabbed Dominica by the shoulders, and pressed his lips on hers. She stiffened, then relaxed, and finally put her hands on his chest and gently pushed him back. "We don't have time, not remotely enough time, to tell you I'm sorry about what I said to you," said Nate. "There's no time to tell you what you mean to me as a woman, as a lover, as a partner. And there's no time to tell you how much I will miss you. I'm supposed to talk to you about continuing our clandestine relationship, about how you should keep operating for the CIA in Moscow. I don't care about that right now. I know you're going back just to save the general. I would do the same, so whatever happens, you've delivered him."
but I want you to stay safe. None of this is worth it. You're the only thing that's important, at least to me."
Nate looked self-consciously away, through the van windshield at the fog-shredded roadway, a time tunnel receding into Russia. Dominika turned to look at the same thing, making up her mind.
"You needn't worry about me, Nate," said Dominika flatly. "I'm going back to my country among my own people. I will be fine. How convenient it has been for you to apologize and tell me you will worry about me 5 minutes before I cross the border." "Please do me a favor," said Dominika. "Don't give me a second thought." "Dushka, let me go," she thought.
She got out of her seat, slid to the back door, and tapped on the glass. Nate watched her go. He stared at the fog, hands clasped behind his head. Gable saw her eyes and knew she was holding on by a thread. Goddamn Nash. She needed stiffening, and fast. He steered her to the car, screened by the van.
"Get in," said Gable. "I want to talk to you."
She slid across the back seat and Gable climbed in beside her, slammed the door. He played it rough, pretending not to notice her eyes. "There will be about a dozen binoculars on you the minute you step outside this vehicle into the clear," Gable said. "Guards will be worrying about security, but there will be others looking at you. Counterintelligence guys, the CI monkeys, looking specifically at you. You understand?" Dominika avoided looking at him and nodded. "When you cross, walk at a steady pace. Not too fast, but not hesitant either. It's important that you don't look at Korchnoi when you pass him on the bridge. He's a traitor, and you were the one who put him in prison," said Gable. "They might call for you both to stop at the midway point on the roadway. It's marked with a line of asphalt, a little bump in the road. It's normal. The guards aren't happy unless they're shouting into bullhorns. They probably will be transmitting video images of you back to the center to confirm your identity." Dominika was better. Gable could see she had started thinking about the walk ahead and not Nash. "Steady pace right up to the trucks. There'll be a Leningrad knuckle-dragger in a bad suit who steps up to say..." What will he say?
"Dobro pozdravljaya," said Dominika, staring out the window. "Welcome home."
"Yeah, well, do me a favor and kick him between the legs. Your behavior from then on is critical."
"Remember," said Gable, "you're coming home, freed from CIA custody. You're relieved and, well, safe. Not exactly talkative, that would be inappropriate. You've accounted for 3 KIAs, your own frigging people tried to kill you and you're pissed. You'll be surrounded by all those Leningrad thugs in the car, or on the train, or however they get you up to St. Petersburg."
"I'm familiar with the species," said Dominika. "There will be no trouble from them. I've just come back from an operation for the center. The only people I will talk to are in Moscow."
"Exactly. And once you're there, show them your Greek stitches and yell about the Spetsnaz maniac, and about Korchnoi and what took them so long to come get you. You're back, baby. You're back."
"Yes," said Dominika. "I am back."
"And we'll see you in 6 months," said Gable.
"Do not count on it," said Dominika.
"You remember the universal call-out number?"
"I threw it away," Dominika said.
"After you memorized it," said Gable.
"Tell Forsyth goodbye for me," she said, ignoring him.
Ludmila Mikhalvina Pavlichenko was the storied Red Army sniper, the deadliest female sniper in history, with 309 confirmed kills during the Crimean campaign in World War II. This evening, on the ruined south tower of the Ivangorod fortress on the Russian riverbank, her namesake Ludmila Tsukhanova, the primary sniper of SVR Special Group B, eased onto her stomach and settled herself. She was dressed in a baggy black coverall, a hood pulled over her head tight around her cherry-splotched face. Her felt-soled boots were splayed out flat behind her. She snugged the VSS Vinterez rifle, the thread cutter, against her riotous, chapped cheek and sighted through the NSPU-3 nightscope 300 meters diagonally across the water at the western end of the Narva Bridge. This would be a night shot comfortably within her ability. She was looking for a profile, a dark-haired woman who walked with a slight limp. The medium Mi-14 Hayes helicopter with the black Mickey Mouse nose was a civilian transport version painted red and white. It settled slowly into the empty parking lot of the Ivangorod railroad station. The mustard walls of the station's Baroque facade flashed pink in the range lights of the helicopter. As the helicopter bounced on its gear, the engine note dropped from a scream to a whine to a purr. The massive rotors stopped spinning and drooped, hot in the chilly night air. No doors opened on the helicopter until two of the SBR cars that had been waiting down the road pulled up tight alongside. The side passenger door opened, and two men in suits banged the metal stairs down and walked a frail white-haired figure to the lead car. The two cars drove slowly up the road to the blocking trucks at the bridge, and the three men got out, one on each side supporting the smaller man. They squeezed past the trucks and stood silently, unmoving, while looking down the roadway at the dim figures at the other end. The border guards around the trucks unslung their rifles, and the spotlights on the trucks came on, flooding the Russian side of the bridge in light. The railings and light pole stanchions cast slanted shadows across the roadway. There were half a dozen cherry pinpricks of light behind the window of the customs toll booth. The Leningrad boys were smoking, watching, not talking. They got out of the van and came around to stand in front, facing the Russians. The Russian spots came on, and Benford signaled to the Kaipo jeep to turn on its headlights and single spotlight. The Russian side was now obscured by a glaring wall of light past which the fog continued to billow. "We'll walk you to the start of the bridge," Gable said, holding Dominika's arm steady. Benford stepped close and stood on the other side of her, holding her other arm above the elbow. Nate had exited the van and stood to one side. Gable and Benford walked forward. "Wait," said Dominika, and she leaned toward Nate and slapped him hard across the cheek. "Atta girl," said Gable. The Kaipo troopers in the jeep nudged one another. Dominika and Nate looked at each other for a beat, no one else in the entire fog-shrouded world. Then Dominika whispered, "Polka, be seeing you." She straightened and pulled Gable and Benford forward. "Come on," she said. "Be cool, baby," Gable said out of the corner of his mouth. He and Benford steered Dominika by each arm, like custodians in a prison. Her hands were fists as she resisted their pressure. They walked up to the beginning of the bridge roadway and stood there, watching the fog spill over the span. At the far end of the bridge, there were flashes of cars pulling up, impossible to make out details. And there was a flurry of movement, then three men silhouetted at the other end, a short one in the middle. A spotlight winked off, then on again, then Benford signaled the troopers to send the same signal. The Kaipo lights glinted off a dozen binoculars looking at them. "Stop when you get to the center," Gable said. Dominika contemptuously tore both her arms free of their grasp, told them, "Yaptavuyo mat," straightened her coat and stepped forward. With that slight hitch, she began walking into the fog, head up, ballet calves flexing, shoulders back. The short figure at the far end of the bridge also began walking. "What did she say?" asked Benford.
"Sounded fairly obscene," said Gable.
Dominika's silhouette grew less distinct as she passed progressively through the faint circles of light on the roadway. She and the solitary figure walking the other way were nearly abreast of each other.
"She's at mid-span with marble now," said Gable softly.
A bullhorn barked something and the two figures stopped. The two silhouettes were standing side by side in mid-span, in the light of one of the lamps, fog swirling between them, soaking them. Dominika looked straight ahead, imperious, disdaining. She never turned her head, but she could feel his majestic purple presence. It was the last time she'd feel him. Marble looked over at Dominika, his white hair caught in the lamplight, and he shrugged off his overcoat and held it to her, an offering from one exchanged spy to another. Dominica took the coat and dropped it on the fog-wet pavement, just as Marble had hoped she would do. The light glinted off a dozen binoculars. Marble looked straight ahead, noting the city glow of Narva, the loom of the castle keep, the wink of a star in the western sky, the headlights and silhouettes of the men at the far end of the bridge. When lights on both ends of the bridge flashed again, he began walking. He heard Dominica's footsteps fading behind him. His body felt light. The pains were familiar, but the hollowness in his chest was gone. His head was clear, and he concentrated on not walking too fast. He would show them to the last how a professional finishes. As he came nearer, the silhouettes turned into faces, familiar faces. It was more important to see his friends than it was to actually be free. Benford, Nathaniel, a spy swap. He almost laughed. The 9x39mm round from Ludmila's suppressed rifle passed through the left side of Marble's neck, severing his carotid artery before exiting his right pectoral muscle below the armpit. Sukhanova, intending a headshot, had held a touch low, and the cold night air had affected the subsonic SP-5 round. She was up and walking her egress route along the South Fortress wall before Marble's legs buckled. The Russians on their side of the bridge did not know anything had happened. Benford caught him, but Marble's dead weight slipped through his arms and the old man collapsed to the wet asphalt. Nate sat on the roadway and cradled Marble's head against his thigh, but the old spy was still. They had flipped a switch on him, and he was gone, eyes closed, face strangely composed. Benford looked at his hands, red with Korchnoi's blood. The Kaipo troopers unslung their galils and brought them up, but Gable screamed stop and waved them to stand down. Across the bridge, Dominica turned briefly. She had heard Gable's bellow, but she was swallowed up in the searchlight's glare. She registered the dark knot of figures around the black lump on the ground, and she knew instinctively what had happened. She screamed no once in her head, then willed herself to close down, to compose her face, relax her shoulders. She was hustled into a waiting vehicle, a heated Mercedes, luxuriously warm, which immediately sped off down the highway. The car rocked around the curves, and she contained her horror, replaying images of Korchnoi. She choked down her venomous rage as a yellow-draped Leningrad colonel filled the inside of the car with cigarette smoke. Benford looked down at Marble, paralyzed, unable to move, unable to think. Nate's head was bowed, and his hands shook as he continued cradling Marble's head in his lap. This was violence too cruel. They were speechless, insensate with the finality, the irretrievability of Marble's lost life. They were shaken by the despot's towering treachery, the enormity of the ruthless act. All except Gable. He quickly stepped back out into the roadway and raised his binoculars. A jumble of silhouettes on the Russian side was moving around. The taillights of a luxury sedan receded into the night. Gable could not tell whether Dominica had seen what had happened, but he hoped she had. Please God she knows what happened. The fog swirled around them, wetting their hair, touching Marble's placid face. The old man's sodden overcoat lay forgotten at the middle of the bridge.
Red Sparrow, a novel, was written by Jason Matthews and read by Jeremy Bobb. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Joanna Solotaroff. Red Sparrow, a novel, was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Red Sparrow is available in hardcover from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.